Hello and welcome to the Iota Unum podcasts from the Latin Mass Society. In the company of some great friends of tradition from around the world, we will be drilling into some of the fundamental issues affecting us today in the church and the world. So I thought I could, having written this presentation in the course of my travels in Ireland, because it was a quite last minute arrangement, I'm very happy to do it, because it's fed off what I've been talking about in Galway and in Dublin, and the questions I was asked and the way that my thinking has developed with beyond the two books which I've published last year about related matters. I thought I could give this a subtitle, and McQuaid was right. It's about Catholic culture and the formation of families. You might be entitled, though, to think it was a bit cheeky of me, British Catholic, lecturing Irish Catholics about Catholic culture, because, to be crass, you've got one. And we don't so much. We don't have nothing, but it's not the same. And we are very conscious of that in England. We're very conscious that England's not a Catholic culture. We don't have a great deal of public Catholic art. We don't have Catholic cultural traditions in the public space, in mainstream schools, and so on. Last year, I attended a deeply impressive Corpus Christi procession in Munich. And I regularly go to Italy, where you have so much, you know, Catholic iconography on the corners of buildings and things. It's very evident to us in England there's more air to breathe in places where Catholicism, the faith, has become rooted in culture, for all the problems we all experience in our different countries. On the other hand, given the direction of travel in the West, my experience of living as a Catholic in a country where there is very little in the way of Catholic culture may give me a useful perspective. You may even view me as a visitor from the future, one possible future that you have here. This is the future that awaits us all if we don't value Catholic culture and pass it on to our children, indeed if we have children. The danger does not just arise from a lack of seriousness about the faith. And that's really my concern here. This is not just a matter of, you know, our opponents, you know, in the political sphere. It's, or even liberal Catholics in the way that we normally think of them, people who don't really believe. It's a problem which comes from a much wider spectrum of opinion within the church. One of the things that made me realise this was a conversation I was involved in. I wasn't the principal person, but I was sort of on the edge of this conversation with an old headmaster of my old school. So I went to Amberforth College, a Benedictine Catholic boys' school. It was boys in those days. It's gone mixed. And this man, Father Leo Chamberlain, OSB, he had been the headmaster after I'd left. While I was there, he was a housemaster. And he was explaining to someone else what had happened after the council in the school. He explained that there was an old view. An old view was that the boys would absorb the faith by osmosis. So you put them into a supersaturated solution of Catholicism, and you take them out a week later and they've soaked it up. And you leave them there for 5 years and it's great, they come out and they're kind of really Catholic. And he said, well, this is wrong. This is all wrong. It's based on a fundamental mistake. And I thought, gosh, what's he going to say next? What's the correct view? The correct view, according to him, and he's simply reflecting, you know, the view they took in the 70s in the school, his superiors, not his generation, but people a bit older than him. The correct view was that the boys should be able to see the faith at a distance and then make a decision to move towards it. I don't think he had in mind a conversion experience exactly, something less dramatic. But nevertheless, what was important was that it was an act of will on the part of the boys. So having been aware of the debate about Catholic ethos in schools, by the time I'd had this, listening to this conversation, my jaw was on the floor as I heard Father Chamberlain explain that the monks of Amberforth had deliberately secularised the school in the 1970s. It didn't happen by accident or by the intervention of non-Catholic members of staff. It didn't happen because of pressure from parents. It didn't happen because of pressure from the government, school inspectors. It happened because they thought it would be better for the faith of the children in their care. So one example of this de-Catholicising of Amberforth, which as a matter of fact, Father Chamberlain personally regretted. So the one thing I regret is we stopped having half holidays for religious feasts like St Benedict's Day. And another feature of Amberforth in the old days, which went down in legend and song, in fact, was the fact they were very faithful to the Angelus. So if they were playing a cricket match and it was 6 o'clock and the bell struck, they put down their cricket bats and the visiting team was absolutely amazed to see them all kind of genuflecting and making the sign of the cross. Real witness to the faith. They stopped that as well. But no doubt there are lots of other things. Boys serving early morning daily masses, processions, devotional art, sacramentals, compulsory daily mass, and so on and so forth. The contrast between the old and the new attitude, that's not unique to Amberforth. So that was happening in a lot of places, and that debate is still going on. And a recent example of this debate, which struck me very forcibly, is going on in the Church of England at the moment. The Church of England, in watching themselves basically going down the tubes, and they're getting a bit fidgety about this process, so casting about for what to do. So they look at the best performing parts of Anglicanism. So what are the best performing parts? Where are the kind of young people? Where's this energy? Where's that? And of course, it's the evangelical congregations. Now these congregations, they don't really care about the theological training of their clergy, if you were to call them clergy. It's of no importance. And nor church buildings. They don't care about the buildings. To these congregations, all they need is a room to meet in and someone to lead the prayers. They can go very quickly and they can plant new versions of themselves in new places at effectively zero cost. The Church of England at the moment pays vast sums of money on the salaries of theologically trained clergy. Their training is not like Catholic clerical training, but there is some. And vast sums on church buildings. Some of them, of course, historic, not all of them. So maybe they've been doing this all wrong. If they were to direct, this is the question in their minds now, if they were to direct some significant portion of this cash towards encouraging house-based evangelical congregations to spread like a virus across the country, something good might happen. Too bad for the existing congregations in their historic church buildings and the expensive professional clergy who look after them, who would be starved of funds. That's the proposal, basically. But you can't make an omelette without breaking a few eggs. And this is, as you can imagine, this has provoked a massive reaction. So if you want to find out about it, you can find an organisation online called Save the Parish, and that is basically what the debate about this in the Anglican Church is about, Save the Parish, the parochial system. One phrase particularly struck me in this debate, used by a proponent of the scheme, there would be, he said, and I quote, no passengers. What he means is every member of these new congregations would be a dynamo of evangelizing energy. None would be just there for the ride. Of course, he or she wouldn't know the difference between the Blessed Trinity and a hole in the wall. But who cares? That doesn't matter. If they love Jesus, who Who cares about that? So, now there is a particular anti-intellectual and anti-institutional flavour to this proposal, which is characteristic of evangelical Christianity, and I'll come back to that. But there is more to this which crosses the confessional divide. The connection between what Aberforth College did in the 1970s and what is being proposed for the Church of England now is encapsulated by a phrase which has become used in a lot of recent books, and that is an intentional community. So an intentional community, Wikipedia tells me, is, and I quote, a group of people who have chosen to live together with a common purpose, working cooperatively to create a lifestyle that reflects their shared core values, unquote. So church congregations don't usually live together, but they are still a group of people who haven't ended up together by mere chance or habit. Rather, the community is a result of a positive decision by each member. This is regarded as a solution to all our problems because, the thinking goes, our problems derive from spiritual lethargy. People go to church out of habit or a sense of obligation, and they are a dead weight. They are passengers. What we need is people who want to be there because they have chosen to be there, who have commitment and zeal. This is the argument. Father Chamberlain wanted to create people who would be members of such communities, and the Anglican spokesman I quoted wants to deploy them. Now, we may observe in passing that just because someone has chosen to be in a particular place, it does not follow that he will be dedicated and hardworking once he is there. A failure to realise this suggests an interesting naivety about the world of work. This is something else I shall return to, but for now, let's consider what intentional communities are like. The ultimate intentional community, I suppose, is a monastic community. Everyone there is there because they have chosen it with a high level of commitment. And then there are married couples who have obviously taken a very serious decision and sealed it with a public act of commitment. But, and here's the question, what about children? Are families as a whole intentional communities? Obviously not. Children do not arrive in a family through choice. They are committed to the family, but this commitment cannot be derived from any kind of consent or decision that they have made, at least until they have the option of moving out. Even then, young adults who decide to remain in the family home don't do so normally because they want to advance the shared values of the family, but more probably because mum can do their laundry for them. Nor do they choose to join a particular family. Not only do they not choose to join a particular family, but at the time of their arrival, there is zero correspondence between their values and those of the families in which they are sprung. Because, of course, newborn babies have no particular values, moral or cultural, except those implied simply by being human. If you think about parish communities, the same is true. For them, at least, for the vast majority of the history of the church. Historically, most people attended Mass in a particular place because they were born there. If they had moved into the parish, it would have been for reasons completely unconnected with the faith, almost certainly for reasons of work or marriage. In choosing where to live, a pious Catholic between the years 300 and 1950 might have been influenced by the desire to get to Mass, but unless they were an oblate of a monastery or something like that, it is difficult to imagine them checking out the local places of worship to get a sense of their ecclesial flavour before choosing a home closest to the one that suited them best. Since parishes and families are usually regarded as the foundational elements of the local church, the fact that they are not intentional communities creates a problem for those who think that intentional communities are the way forward. One way of resolving this problem is to try and make parishes and families more intentional. With parishes, it's not too difficult to move in this direction, although it is telling that the possibility depends on widespread car ownership. Parishes could be allowed to diverge in churchmanship, as the Anglicans would call it, and people can be encouraged to shop around if that is what you want to happen, but it is not so easy to do that in families. Some parents, in fact, do try to do this. Some liberal Christian parents are uncomfortable with infant baptism and say their children should choose a faith when they are old enough to do so. I imagine that most of these liberal parents would nevertheless regard it as a dereliction of duty not to inculcate the values of table manners and doing one's homework into the children. Do these parents think that using a knife and fork is more important than the eternal fate of their children's souls? I suspect the answer is they don't really believe that there is anything as heavy as the eternal fate of a soul involved. For them, religious affiliation is simply a lifestyle choice. Before moving on, I should note that the secular counterpart of the reluctance of parents to baptise their children is causing a crisis of legitimacy for the family. We are increasingly hearing progressives tell us that the ideologically based friendship groups of, for example, transgender children are more real, more important than their biological families. These friendship groups are sometimes called elective families. And because it has the sanction of consent and choice, that gives them more legitimacy. As far as the quasi-elective religious family is concerned, this lack of seriousness about religion is more or less the opposite of what the advocates of intentional communities promised us. Intentional communities are supposed to be full of people who are red hot in the faith, totally committed and determined to spread the gospel. It turns out that the preference for intentional communities over the non-intentional kind is only possible if you trivialise the importance of the faith to the point of insignificance. If you think the faith is actually important, you will do with it what you do with all your other key values and cultural treasures, which is to pass them on, not primarily through a conscious choice on the part of the recipients, but, to use Father Chamberlain's word, by osmosis. This is not to deny that there are such things as intentional communities in the church, and indeed they are more widespread than they used to be. Parishes have become more intentional as Catholics equipped with motor cars seek out or avoid liturgical abuses, the Polish language mass, the neo-catechumenate, or the traditional Latin option, or a priest who doesn't mention hell or contraception. In a different way, Catholics still attending Mass after going to university have certainly made a positive decision to do so against significant social pressure. Supporters of intentional communities should be delighted by these developments, but it doesn't have the significance that they think it has. It doesn't, for the most part, mark the emergence of a more serious-minded, evangelising variety of Catholic. Congregations are still characterised by people hanging on by their fingernails. And every year, some of them fall off to be replaced on the window ledge by people whose faith has weakened in the meantime and will lapse next year or the year after. The proponents of intentionality imagine naively that if someone has made a positive choice for something, that implies a high level of commitment. It doesn't. Choices can result from one option being marginally preferable to the alternatives, an advantage which can easily be lost. The reasons that more and more people in our congregations have made a positive decision to attend Mass, a decision that may well not continue to be made as time goes on, is not because of a sudden outbreak of zeal. It is simply the flip side of the collapse of the alternative and historically dominant reason that Catholics find themselves in church on a Sunday: culture. Those intentional communities coming into existence today that have a future are those like the neo-cats, the oratorians, and the traditionalists who are determined to re-establish a strong Catholic culture and to form their children in it. These are, in fact, intentional communities that would rather not be intentional communities. On reflection, the same is true even of the first examples that I gave: monastic communities and married couples. Religious know very well that the original act of will to join is not enough to sustain a monk or nun in a lifelong vocation and set about to establish a common culture, a sense of home, a feeling of community. Married couples do the same thing and are assisted in this, of course, by romantic love. The act of will is necessary, of course, but it is not sufficient. Even adults need the osmosis. Two tasks remain for me in the rest of this presentation. One is to explain why the proponents of intentional communities downplay the cultural transmission of the faith. The other is to explain why cultural transmission is so effective when it works and how to make it work again. So part two, the rejection of Catholic culture. In the course of the 20th century, and indeed before then, a number of factors have combined to undermine Catholic culture. I have spoken and written about these in other places, and I mention them now just to emphasise that I don't at all think that they were insignificant, and I don't intend to lay all the blame for the lapsations we have seen in recent decades on mistakes made by the Catholic leadership. A lot of it would have happened anyway. Urbanisation, compulsory education, migration, the effects of mass communications, including television, the expansion of higher education, all these things and plenty of others as well, combined to make it more difficult for parents or a cohesive local community to pass on culture to the next generation. My current concern, nevertheless, is not with these vast global trends, but with the ideas that led people not to oppose those trends or to mitigate their effects, but to embrace them and to exaggerate their effects. The ideas that led people, even within the church, to make it even harder to maintain Catholic culture than modern conditions were already making it. Even this narrower question has many aspects, and I've been trying to develop further thoughts on this that I articulated in my two recent books, Liturgy, the Family and the Crisis of Modernity, and The Latin Mass and the Intellectuals. On Thursday in Dublin, I talked about luxury beliefs. On Saturday in Galway, I talked about modernism's attack on tradition. Here I want to explore in more detail a third element, which I've already introduced, the attack on the idea of the cultural transmission of faith. The claim that when culture is transmitted in this way, it is a kind of second-class faith, a necessarily weak commitment, and that implies as an unwillingness to evangelise. One motive for this view is the observation that converts are often more zealous than cradle Catholics. I mean, that may well be true, but it doesn't really get us very far. Then there is the fact that, as I have already noted, the success of the evangelicals, and again, well, that's true, but you look at what happens to those individuals over time, and they don't necessarily maintain their commitment. As a matter of fact, generations of young people have passed through a famous evangelical church in London, which is right next to Brompton Oratory, called Holy Trinity Brompton. Well, generations of people have passed through it. Why are they all under 30? Well, they get married, they move out of London, and they lapse. So that's that. They are seeds planted on shallow soil. But the zeal of the convert and the momentary glow of evangelical enthusiasm are relatively superficial motives for rejecting cultural transmission. Here is Father Brian Houghton in the preface of his 1986 novel, which I very much recommend, incidentally. It's been reprinted, Judith's Marriage, talking about what happened after Vatican II. And I quote from Father Houghton. The new reforms in general, and of the liturgy in particular, were based on the assumption that the Catholic laity were a set of ignorant fools. They practiced out of tribal custom, their veneration of the cross and the mass was totem worship, they were motivated by nothing more than fear of hell, their piety was superstition, and their loyalty, habit. But the most gratuitous insult of all was that most Catholics had a Sunday religion which in no way affected their weekday behaviour. This monstrous falsehood was, and still is, maintained by bishops and priests who, for the most part, have never been adult laymen. Every day, the Catholic workman had to put up with the jeers of his colleagues and the more educated with their sneers. Every night they took their religion to bed with them. If you think Father Harrington's characterisation of the attitude of the church's clerical elite in the Vatican II era is too harsh, here is someone we can't ignore, Pope Paul VI himself. Talking about people who lacked enthusiasm for vernacularisation in a general audience in 1965, so Mass went into the Vatican in 1964, he accused them, and I quote, of a certain spiritual indolence, unquote. He explained that the liturgical reform was, and I quote, to shake the passivity of the faithful, who could never again be quiet and devout or lazy in the way they had been before. Before, it was good enough to attend Mass. Now it is necessary to participate. End quote. Sadly, Pope Paul clearly had exactly the attitude described by Houghton, that before the council, the Catholic faithful were only going through the motions. This attitude was ultimately the product of rationalism. Rationalism favours a particular way of engaging with reality, namely by a grasp of propositions. Other ways of engaging with reality are second best or not worth considering for the rationalist. If you can express an idea in words which you can define, then you understand it. If not, you don't have much of a clue. The people Pope Paul is lambasting are those who are not engaging rationally with a liturgy as a set of texts. It does not occur to him to ask, as it had occurred to Pope Pius XII in Mediator Dei only 20 years earlier, that despite not reading or understanding the text as a text, they could still be engaged spiritually through prayer. Historically, a species of rationalism was forced onto the church even before the Enlightenment by the Protestant Reformation. Every heresy forces the church to express clearly and precisely what the true teaching is, crystallising what may have been expressed in all sorts of ways but previously in passages of scripture, church fathers, and the practice of the church. Once this is done, heretics and suspected heretics can be held to the newly minted creedal formulae. Protestantism brought with it a large collection of heresies, and the church responded with an equally large collection of carefully crafted statements of faith, which it was heresy to deny and which needed to be taught to priests and laity, lest they be seduced by Protestant preaching. The Council of Trent did not condemn the people's instinctive devotion to the Blessed Sacrament, for example, or their reliance on the intercession of the saints. On the contrary, it condemned those who condemned it. But to do so, it had to articulate what we believe about these things as never before. And this created an inevitable tendency for the formulae to supplant the instinctive devotion as the centre of attention. Learning these formulae is certainly important. We live today in an environment still shaped by rationalism, and our children need to be able to answer to their own satisfaction, if not to the satisfaction of everyone they talk to, all sorts of carping and sophistical objections to the faith. Many hours in the Shaw household are devoted to the difference between sanctifying and actual grace, the matter and form of the sacraments, and the conditions of mortal sin. We just have to be mindful of what this kind of formation does and what it does not do. It enables us to deal with a young twerp from the Christian Union when we're at university. It does not, on its own, give us the gift of faith. As St. James reminds us, "Thou believest that there is one God. Thou dost well. The devils also believe and tremble." One of the difficulties presented by modern Western culture is that, as well as a rationalist disdain for an instinctive faith, we are simultaneously affected by a romantic aversion to creedal formulas. Romanticism and rationalism are the ill-matched twin offspring of the Enlightenment, reacting against each other over the centuries. Romanticism takes up with the anti-intellectualism of some forms of Protestantism to tell us that these old catechisms are a waste of time and that we just need a teary-eyed emotional assent to the overwhelming love shown us by Jesus. Protestantism also tells us that all the traditions and devotions are also wrong because they come between us and our direct, unmediated encounter with Christ. Rationalism and romantic anti-intellectualism are opposite errors that both respond to something which the Enlightenment refuses to understand, and that is culture. Culture is directly rejected by rationalism because, while this is perfectly rational, it is not a matter of propositions. It is rejected by anti-intellectualism because it is complex, it can be mastered only with discipline, and accepted only by those who respect authority. It is culture that is the missing element in the endless, sterile debate between those who think that the Penny Catechism could save the world if only we had enough copies of it, and those who think that working young people into an emotional frenzy about the love of God will have a lasting effect. What do I mean by culture? It is the understanding of the Blessed Sacrament instilled by the habit of genuflecting in front of the tabernacle. It is the respect for Our Lady and the saints inculcated by seeing them honoured with incense, flowers and processions. It is a sense of the seriousness of sin which is evinced by the discipline of fasting and abstinence and regular confession. It is the joy of Easter and Christmas which is heightened by the penance, vigils and unique types of liturgy which precede them. It is the effect on one's order of values by seeing the prominence and beauty of the altar in church, of Sunday in the week and of the sacrament of marriage in family life. It is the formation in our imaginations of the concept of heroism by reference to the sacrifice of the martyrs and of Christ, the King of martyrs, seeing them honoured in the places where they suffered. Another aspect of culture has been expressed by sociologists of religion with the phrase, rather ugly phrase, credibility-enhancing displays. This happens when a believer does something which manifests his or her faith in a costly way, demonstrating to others, believers and non-believers alike, that their faith is real and unfeigned. The ultimate example is martyrdom. No one goes to martyrdom for beliefs that he doesn't really hold. Others include getting up in the middle of the night to watch before the Blessed Sacrament, completing a long walking pilgrimage, or the community coming together to build a church. These sorts of things, the special character of Sunday, the genuflections and so on, can be said to convey the faith, even in a propositional way. People with a strong Catholic culture could say, for example, that the Blessed Sacrament is worthy of the highest form of worship, having been to benediction. But when it comes to accurate verbal formulae, we have catechesis. Where cultural formation comes into its own is making the teaching of the church credible and making the implications of that teaching sink into our bones as habits. Good habits, that is to say, virtues. In the annals of history, we frequently find members of the faithful who evidently had a very limited theological formation rejecting the trite arguments of heretics because these contradicted what, in a deep sense, they knew to be true. An example cited by Eamon Duffy in The Stripping of the Altars is the annoyance of a Lollard preacher whose exposition against the Blessed Sacrament was interrupted by the ringing of a Sanctus bell. His audience melted away when the faithful all rushed off to see the elevation. Particularly striking are the words of one of the Catholic martyrs executed in Oxford in 1589, an in-servant called Humphrey Pritchard. He was challenged on his ignorance of theology by a Protestant minister. This is right in front of the gallows on which he was to die. And he replied that, and I quote, "What I cannot explain by mouth, I am ready and prepared to explain and testify to you at the cost of my blood." Unquote. He had received his faith by cultural transmission. He knew that his martyrdom would be a way of passing it on, not by speaking, not but dying, not by propositions, but by example. which is to say, by cultural transmission. He was beatified in 1987. As this example illustrates, the transmission of the faith by culture is not something easy. It is not that if we leave it to culture, we can all relax and stop worrying about it. Culture is hard, it is complex, it is costly, it is often embarrassing. The effort to keep it up can never be allowed to slacken, and it takes decades for it to have an effect. I am sure when the monks of Aberforth and various other Catholic teachers, bishops and parents decided at different times that the young people should see the faith at a distance and spontaneously decide, or not decide, to move towards it, that must have been a huge relief to them. Far, far easier to leave things to the moving, the mysterious movement of the Holy Spirit than to do the laborious work of making the Abbey Church look festive for St. Benedict, interrupt cricket matches for the Angelus, plan processions, give out sacramentals, lead devotions, read Children the Lives of the Saints, take them on pilgrimages, and all the rest of it. What a weight off our shoulders to accept the argument that real faith comes from an act of will, not the slow development of understanding and devotional habit by culture. So, part three. I'm getting towards the end now. Restoring Catholic family culture. The church at the institutional level appears to have given up on the cultural transmission of the faith. Instead, initiatives, even by the more conservative Catholic writers and bishops, focus relentlessly on catechesis. It seems that every other year there is an exciting new catechetical programme, usually from America, which is going to be rolled out in this or that diocese and solve all our problems. Far be it from me to deny that most Catholics today are very poorly catechised. That's obviously true. But they are also very poorly formed in Catholic culture. Attempting to catechise young people who are not culturally Catholic is pretty difficult. I don't just mean, as a friend of mine at university explained to me growing up in Preston, that the Catholics listened to U2 and supported Celtic, and the Protestants supported Rangers. Well, that's not what I mean by Catholic culture. Indeed, it is clear by now that despite great efforts and resources being put into this project, the attempt, however noble, has not met with success. In the meantime, the processes by which Catholic culture is passed on continue to be undermined, even by the Holy See itself. On each occasion that some concession to secular culture is made that will undermine Catholic culture some more, we are told that the damage can be repaired by catechesis. Allow me to quote a blog post I wrote in 2019. When communion in the hand was permitted, bishops were told by the Congregation for Divine Worship, and I quote, "It is above all necessary that an adequate catechesis prepares the way so that the faithful understand the significance of the action and will perform it with a respect due to the sacrament. The result of this catechesis should be to remove any suggestion of wavering on the part of the church in its faith in the Eucharistic presence," unquote. When females were allowed to serve at the altar, the same congregation, and this is like 30 years later, the same congregation had a parallel worry, insisting that, and I quote, "It must be clearly explained to the faithful," unquote, to wit, that the ministries open to women are very different from ordained ministries, something which may be far from obvious. That congregation was also worried that the sight of lots of lay people bustling about with their ministries at Mass would imply that everyone should be doing something. It begged that, and I quote again, "catechetical instruction should strive diligently to correct those widespread superficial notions and practices often seen in recent years in this regard," unquote. Again, should the faithful draw the theological conclusion apparently indicated by the reception of Holy Communion under both kinds, that reception of the chalice adds something to reception of the host, the congregation pleads that they be headed off from any such conclusion. How? the practice should be, and I quote, preceded and continually accompanied by proper catechesis regarding the dogmatic principles on this matter laid down by the Ecumenical Council of Trent, unquote. In each case, the fear was that a practice would encourage error, which would have to be countered by a special effort of preaching and formation. In other words, the liturgical practice could potentially form a kind of counter-catechesis. And that is to say nothing about practices which are contrary to liturgical law. Pope John Paul II was stating the obvious when he observed that, and I quote, in various parts of the church, abuses have occurred, leading to confusion with regard to sound faith and Catholic doctrine concerning this wonderful sacrament, unquote. And that's the end of my self-quotation. We cannot hope to influence the policy of the Holy See, sadly, or probably even our local diocese. But what we can have an effect on is the culture of our own homes. We Catholic parents could let our children wallow in a culture hostile to the faith and then attempt to correct their errors with careful catechesis, but I would suggest that this is quite a bad idea. Instead, each of us must do what we can to create a Catholic environment in our homes in which our children can pick up habits of devotion and an instinctive understanding of the Catholic worldview by osmosis. On that foundation, we can make the teachings of the Church explicit with catechesis. This is not the easy option, but it is the option that has some hope of success. This podcast was brought to you by the Latin Mass Society. We hope you enjoyed it and would appreciate your rating the podcast on the platform you are using. If you would like to find out more, do visit our website and consider joining us or giving us a donation.